OT After Dark is a podcast run by two occupational therapists and is for adults only. We believe that sex and sexual pleasure are a human right for consenting adults, regardless of ability, age, gender, or sexual orientation. We discuss topics that cover a wide variety of intimacy and sexual practices. To be true to our strong views regarding inclusivity, we use common and slang terms regarding sexual topics, which may be considered explicit. Listener discretion is advised.
We have exciting news to share. We recently partnered with DirectRec, a free app for OT practitioners, PT practitioners, and speech-language pathologists.
DirectRec helps clinicians to find peer-vetted products, and we recently have added our own recommendations of products on DirectRec for sexual health and wellness.
We helped DirectRec get a little extra sexy. DirectRec helps clinicians share products and other digital info, like YouTube videos and Google Docs, with their clients.
DirectRec helps you to track clients' follow-through on your product recommendations. So to start using DirectRec, click on the link on our website at otafterdark.com or in our social media bios.
Hi, I'm Kay.
And I'm JJ.
And we're both occupational therapists.
And we're here talking to you about sex.
We got something fun for you today.
On this episode, we talked to Dr. Mark Levant, who is an interdisciplinary sexuality educator. And he talks to us from a sexuality educator perspective, really about how we should be having these conversations about sex.
And he has some really good tidbits and some really good resources, some books to read. So he's going to talk about a lot of books. Don't worry about trying to scribble those down, because we'll go ahead and put those on the website for you, as we always try to do.
Yep, those will all be posted for you. So sit back, relax, and enjoy Dr. Mark Levant.
Maybe pour yourself a glass of wine.
All right.
All right, so we are here today with Mark Levant, who is an interdisciplinary sexuality educator. Welcome, Mark.
Hey, Mark.
So excited that you are Dark with us.
Thanks. I'm glad to be here.
Yeah. So why don't you give us a little bit of your background and why you're here?
Sure. A little bit about my background. As an interdisciplinary sexuality educator and researcher, I teach courses largely on sexuality in the health sciences, different types of things, usually at the undergrad level. I teach graduate students and different counseling professionals about certain things around sexuality, specifically around counseling sexuality and keeping their own awareness about different sexual topics and then what happens inside of them when they're talking about sex. So I teach counseling professionals, and I write on sexuality from a variety of disciplines and topics. Just a couple things that I have written on involve therapeutic practices and healthcare professionals and working around issues of alternative sexual practices and different things on consent and philosophy and different stuff like that. And my doctoral coursework was actually in researching the way that sexuality happens in Catholic institutions of higher education, so at Catholic colleges and universities, how changes around sexuality happen, and what works or doesn't work around that.
That sounds, as someone who was raised Catholic, that sounds very interesting.
Yeah, well,
I need to have you on again and talk a little bit more about that.
A little separate.
Oh yeah, that's a very different thing. I don't know too much about the intersections of the Catholic world and the OT world, but intersections of Catholic and sexuality, that's actually my large title. I do Catholic theology in a different capacity.
That's a whole other podcast I want to do.
Right.
Tell me about it.
So we're here. So
you're going to talk to us about how healthcare professionals can be more comfortable talking about sex with their clients.
Because that's probably the number one question we get is, how do we bring it up? How do we get patients comfortable talking to us? All that stuff. Everyone wants to address it with their clients, but no one knows how to broach the topic.
Right. When you say that's the number one question we get, like, who do you get, like, from listeners?
Listeners. Yeah.
And that comes from students, like, practitioners.
Yeah. I teach, so a lot of students, that's usually the first thing students ask is, like, okay, I get that it applies to OT, but how do we start that conversation?
And how do your students usually start that conversation? Or do they say, I don't know?
My recommendation is usually, when you're explaining what OT is, you have to, you're explaining that it's, we're addressing, you just kind of throw it in the mix, which I don't think is necessarily the best way to do it. But, like, we can address things like bathing, dressing, home management. And then you're also going to say, we can address sexual activity. And if there's issues in that area, you're kind of, when you're covering that broad scope of what occupational therapy can address, that we at least in that initial phase mention that that's one of them. Now, we had another podcast talking about some models, and one of those models talks about how it needs to be, you need to be kind of constantly bringing it up in a way that just gives them permission to talk about it. But easier said than done.
Right.
Yes. Excellent. Yeah. I think I listened to that one. You mentioned a definition from a whole bunch of different organizations. I listened to one where you talked about definitions from different organizations about, like, sexual activity and, like, sexual health and, like, what that says and what that looks like in the field of OT.
Yes. I think that was our first episode where we just kind of defined what sex is and what OTs define sex and sexual activity, and that it also falls under social participation.
Right. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
Awesome. Yeah. And I mean, that's really good. And it's actually not too much different than what we as sexuality educators. So, when I say sexuality educator, I'm certified by the American Association of Sexuality Educators, Counselors, and Therapists, or ASECT, A-A-S-E-C-T. And one of the things that ASECT works towards is expanding the field of sex education, the fields of sex counseling, and the fields of sex therapy as well. And so as sex educators, we do that very same thing where we say, you know, with children, when parents are like, how do we talk to our kids about sex? That same, like, ongoing conversation, definitely how that kind of works there too. But with healthcare professions, what's really interesting is that there's sometimes a very different capacity, in that there's a different power dynamic where, you know, as a healthcare professional, people come to you and they're like, you know, you're the expert.
Yeah.
They're gonna come to you.
Yeah.
Right. And so if you're uncomfortable talking about sex, which I know that you two are not, after having listened to some podcasts. So that's nice. But if a healthcare professional is uncomfortable talking about sex, then just like children do with parents, when they don't talk about sex, they get the message, okay, this isn't safe to bring up here. Mm-hmm. This isn't okay. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And in the past, I've educated OT and PT students. Right at that transition where they pass their senior year and they're in their first year of grad school. Mm-hmm. And sometimes talking about sex with them is very difficult. There's a lot of, like, giggles in the classroom, and the field sometimes struggles with, you know, getting into talking about sex mm-hmm. with them.
Yeah. I get a lot of giggles in my classroom when it comes up.
It's that uncomfortable laughter that
we're not, but we don't live in a society where we're supposed to talk about this.
Yeah, definitely. And that's why one of my, like, so I made a little list of things, and that list kind of then trails off into other things. But one of my favorite things to first talk about with students that are in healthcare professions is to first and foremost, like, check your own shit, like, understand what's important. And this is in the counseling profession, does a really good job of talking about this as, like, countertransference. You know, like, what is it that you bring? Do you talk about countertransference in OT?
Not in that way, but I think I know where you're going. So keep going.
All right, cool. Whatever you bring to the therapeutic relationship, or in this case, a counseling relationship, would you as OT professionals call yourselves like counselors, or would you say occupational therapists, you'd call yourselves therapists? Like, what's the lingo here?
Practitioner or therapist. I feel like the terminology we would use with what you're talking about, I would say would be therapeutic use of self.
Yeah.
Is how we would talk about it in the classroom.
Okay, cool. Therapeutic use of self. Mm-hmm. Right. And so with just like with other types of counselors and therapists, is that what do you bring to that practitioner relationship, that practitioner role? And that is usually one of the biggest things that people have a difficult time assessing for themselves, mm-hmm. right? And like, what am I comfortable talking about sexual? Am I even comfortable saying certain words? You know, penis, vulva, like different types of sex, anal sex. If I can't talk about those things, how are my clients going to be like, hey, I'm having some issues with this position only when I do anal sex, not any other type of penetrative sex. What can we do about that?
Can I tell you how much I love that you said penis and vulva and not penis and vagina?
Yes. Oh, yeah, right. And that's...
Right?
Right? I mean, and that further down the list, one of the things is words and language and the way that we talk, not only like using proper words, right? But I was at a conference, so there's another group called the Society for the Scientific Study of Sexuality, or Quad S. S-S-S-S. Very nice place. But there was a... Nope, it wasn't that conference. It was the ASECT conference, actually. I go to too many conferences. At the ASECT conference, there's a public health professional by the name of Sophia Jawad-Wessel. And she did a really fantastic keynote this year about the language that we use and what that says to people. And she was talking specifically from a public health perspective and teen pregnancy.
Okay.
Versus, like, instead of using teen pregnancy, because that has a lot of value-laden understanding, to use terms like, you know, young parents or young families, mm-hmm. right? And that lets people who are younger, who have children, know, like, okay, you're not approaching me like a problem.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and that's really nice, right? Yeah. And so, and just understanding, like, the nuances of language, especially when talking about sex, very, very important. When we say sex, what do we mean?
Right.
I know that you all talk about tons of things. You talk about, like, oh, there's many different, like, it's not, I hear actually a number of times on your podcasts I've heard, it's more than penis and vagina.
Yep, very important for us to get that across.
It is. And one of my favorite nuances in the world of sexuality studies is when people say sex, what do they mean? There was this was at Quad S. Four of the prominent consent researchers were doing a workshop. And they said, okay, you know, Susie consents to sex with John. What does Susie consent to? Mm-hmm. And then all these people had these different answers. And then someone said, the whole enchilada. And they actually wrote about this in their article in 2016. It was an analysis of consent by Charlene Mullenhard and Terry Humphreys and Chris Joskowski and Zoe Peterson. And, they were like, okay, so does that mean that what she consented to was penetrating John anally with a strap on? And then the guy was like, oh, no. And she's like, great. So now what we're seeing is that the whole enchilada is not very clear, right?
Because yeah. I think it's the same as what does it mean to, quote, lose your virginity? I mean, I think the idea of losing your virginity mm-hmm. used to be a penis and vagina, but clearly, I mean, that excludes a huge segment of the population.
Right.
Losing your virginity is only a penis going in a vagina. Like there's a whole, yeah, the definition of what things are is
very ambiguous.
Very ambiguous. And I'm glad you bring up like losing virginity. That's a really great one because sometimes professionals are like, hey, I'm going to be like super cool and like let people know that they can tell me whatever they want. So I asked this young person like, hey, so when did you lose your virginity? and they were actually non-consensually assaulted sexually at a very young age. Mm-hmm. And they're like, wait, so do you mean like that time? Or like when I first willingly had sex with someone? Like, what do you mean, right?
Complicated.
Yes, yeah. And so being aware of like the way that language works, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. is really, really important. Which actually then brings me to my next one, is sexual trauma. Like sexual trauma, being aware of sexual trauma and how it works, I can't stress enough, is important for practitioners, mm-hmm. Human service professionals, people who work with people in any capacity, much, 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 much more in a bodily capacity. Because one of my favorite things about the field of OT is that you work with people's bodies in ways that very few other people do in our society.
It's a very intimate relationship, like practitioner-client mm-hmm. relationship.
Mm-hmm. Right. And yeah. So actually on that, what is, at least each of you, and I'm guessing there are many, many more answers that you probably know of more than I do, like what are your favorite things about working with people and bodies? Like
So the thing that pops to my mind first is the knowledge of how different people do things. Like we all have this idea of the way we do things. We mm-hmm. kind of all think the way we do things is normal. The way we get dressed is normal, or brush your mm-hmm. hair is quote mm-hmm. normal. I know in like some of my classes, when we like, especially like the first semester students, when we start talking about those little things, like how you get dressed or brush your hair, and mm-hmm. everybody in the room has a slightly different way of doing it. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's a really interesting thing to watch students kind of realize. And it's really interesting as a practitioner to see, like you could see 8 patients in a day and you could be doing similar things, and they're all doing things just ever so slightly with how they move their body and how they sequence things like that.
And I love the problem solving of it. Like, how can I think outside the box, and how can we achieve what it is that you want to achieve? Whether it's, you know, making dinner independently by yourself, or going to the bathroom independently. And, you know, maybe it's not done in a way that you're used to doing it, but then how can we modify it and adapt it or change it in ways that you can still be successful and independent and that it's meaningful to you?
Oh, nice. Yeah, one of the things I always wondered is, like, if anyone's done a study on the various ways that people wipe their ass. Like, I'm always
so many curious. Ways. That would be a great study.
So you don't know of any right now?
Because there's so many things that, like, how
between different equipment and positions.
How much toilet paper people were used, how they, what they do with the toilet paper. Oh, there's,
do you wrap it? Do you pinch it?
Do you take one ply? It's just, there's so many.
Right. And then I wonder if you always, like, lean to one side, does that, like, alter the shape of your abs? If, like, you have a different, like,
you're using the one side, you're stronger on one side.
Yeah, right?
Man. I have to lean towards. Mm-hmm. Some people spread their cheeks, some people don't. There's so many.
Do people stand? Do they stay sitting?
Yeah. I remember actually when I was younger, I had an older cousin, and he had, you know, older cousin friends. And I was, I don't know, some awkward tween age, like maybe 11 or 12. And this was an older cousin. This was probably like the 90s. I don't know. And he goes, so, like, how do you wipe your ass? And I was like, I don't know. And then he's describing all these different, he's like, do you do the squat? Do you, like, lift the leg? Like what do you do? Just to, like, I don't know, get people to having awkward conversations. And I was like, huh, I never thought of that before. And now I think about it all. I'm so curious. I mean, I don't think about it all the time. I'm usually thinking about other things. But the point, very interesting topic. Anyways, so in OT, so as an interdisciplinary scholar, one of the things that I look at, I mentioned some of the disciplines I do are like theology and religious studies and like health studies and psychology, some bio stuff. But one of the things from the humanities or the theology part I'm curious about is like embodiment and the way that people embody things and live things in their body. Do you guys cover any of that in like OT school, or do you know of different programs that do?
So describe to me a little bit more what you're talking about, and then that might, it might click some things here.
Oh, sure. In a lot of different humanities, like when it comes to ethics, It's built on an understanding of how we exist as embodied people in the world. Or like phenomenology of how our bodies live out in the world, or a theology of how we are embodied spirits in the world, and how your body is a way for you to live in the world, and that it is a tactile experience for you to impact your inner self or your essence as you go through the world.
So that sounds very similar to the concept of occupational science, and that we are occupational beings, mm-hmm. and that what we do then kind of defines who we are and then can affect our health and all of those
overall lived experience.
Yeah. So yeah. It's that concept of being an occupational being. By us doing that, then we, you know, we are belonging in the world, and we're being and all of that, and we're doing.
Being, becoming, belonging. All of us.
Yes.
Oh, good. Okay. I guess one of the things I'm thinking is with clients, do you ever have like conversations, might be very early on in school, where you talk about what does your body mean to you? Pretty much can be like a broad question here.
Oh, but now I want to have that conversation.
Yeah.
So that's actually one of my favorite areas of understanding humans in the world is, what does your body mean to you, and how does that change, and does it change? You know, answer yes, it does, but you all know that. Mm-hmm. And like, but how does it change? And then how does that change the way that we continue living in the world, or in a very occupational sense?
So I guess I would say there's conversations early on in looking at like, go through your day, what you do, your normal day. And then usually uh-huh. you'd be like, so now if you had this injury or this diagnosis, how do you think it would change? So to a degree, we're kind of having that.
Yeah.
Kind of in a roundabout way.
Yeah. Yeah. It is. It's totally related. Absolutely. And one of the things I think about here is sexual self schema. Have you all talked about this before? Sabitha Pillai Friedman is a professor at Widener University. And I first heard about this concept through her work on women and breast cancer. And assessing one's sexual self schema, or how one changes as a sexual being after a diagnosis or after surgery or after, you know, different types of medical procedures, because it does impact one's sexuality, but like, what does that mean and how does it work? And so being aware of how a client understands their sexual self schema and if it's changed, because I'm guessing you might interact with a lot of people after some type of like injury or way that their body has changed in a different way.
Yeah.
Yes.
And in many different ways, or are there OTs like, I cover specifically like the bottom half of the body, and they're like, I cover specifically like the left arm of everyone.
I hope not.
Oh yeah, no, hopefully.
I hope not.
Very holistic. So.
They're probably out there, but they're few and far between.
Oh, good. Okay. Well, this is good. Then
OTs that specialize more in types of like shoulder spinal cord injury, brain injury or that kinds of specialties,
but still looking at the whole person and the whole body.
Yeah.
Good. Then yeah, I would totally suggest look into how sexuality is affected by your area, right? You know, spinal cord, obviously I hear is oftentimes talked about in OT with sexuality.
Yeah.
But by and large, solely on sexual functioning.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. How can we get you to do this thing? Because I mean, you know, that is an OT thing, right?
Yes.
But in a very real sense, I come to an occupational therapist and they are also counseling me through my understanding of myself now in a sexual way mm-hmm. after ... injury or the way that my body's changed. And with the sexual self schema, it's really important to, you know, remember that first point is like, check your own stuff.
Mm-hmm. Right?
So if you're like, hey, I'm uncomfortable talking about sex, then there's very little you can do to help someone be like, this is how I thought about myself sexually before. Mm-hmm. How do I do that now?
Yeah.
And so, and getting comfortable with that is really important, because OTs, human service professions, working with people, ASECT, actually, the American Association of Sexuality Educators, Counselors, and Therapists, whatever, said that before. We're just going to go with ASECT from now on. Yep. They certify educators like myself. They certify counselors, which would be, are you familiar with the Plissett model?
Yes, we did an episode about the Plissett model.
Yeah.
And the
model
and the recognition model.
Oh, yes, all of them. So the ASECT kind of works on the Plissett model with, you know, SS being specific suggestions falling under the counselor role. And a lot of nurses, a lot of people in the healthcare field, a lot of PTs and OTs would count as people who can get certified as ASECT certified counselors. So they offer, you know, continuing education credits and programs for people to go through to be like, okay, now I'm skilled enough in understanding sexuality to continue this type of conversation, right? And of course, in an OT specific way, which is super important.
Yeah.
I lost my train of thought though. We were talking about counselors. Y'all are great.
Sexual schema.
Oh, sexual self schema, right. So embodiment for me is one of my favorite things of how people work, because quite frankly, when you don't have a body, now we're talking about paranormal existence in the world, and that's a totally different podcast. But bodies are fantastic things that people apply different meanings to. One of the feeling, I don't know if you've talked about this before. I heard a couple podcasts, people talking about different types of sexual pleasures and like working around sexuality. But there's a very real sense, specifically when working, for example, with cisgender men, that, side note, do you talk about the concepts of cisgender and transgender on this podcast?
I don't think we have.
I don't think we've explicitly said it.
We're looking to do a whole podcast to talk about that, but.
Great. Oh, good, good, good. Okay, well, then Cliff Notes, transgender, someone whose gender identity does not align with what they were assigned at birth. And then cisgender is someone who was assigned a gender identity at birth, and it grows up, the person grows up, and then it matches. Mm-hmm. So cisgender man, boy comes out at birth, doctor says, it's a boy, raise it as a boy. It grows up, it says, yes, I'm a boy, and then grows into, you know, a man in our society and blah, blah, blah. And of course, it's fucked up in all these other ways. but that's a different thing in the way that we socialize men. Again, different podcast. Right. So with cisgender men, getting them to feel sexual sensation through their nipples, right? Sometimes they'd be like, I don't know. No, I just don't. And some people don't, right? Bodies are very different. Nerve pathways are super different. And I believe you also talk about how if someone has a spinal cord injury, their erogenous zone or zones may change or do different, right? So, and really someone can just be exposed to it and think, oh, you know what? Let me give myself permission to feel sexual pleasure through nipples. Mm-hmm. And then after a while and experimentation, that can happen, right? And bodies are just wonderful things like that, but they're also very connected to, you know, our minds and the way that we work and the way that we say what's okay or not okay to feel. And so embodiment, when it comes to being an OT and being comfortable with talking with people about bodies and about sex, it's really important to understand the way that trauma can live in a body. Do you all talk about how trauma can live in a body throughout programs or the way that looks? Like,
I would say that's a part of OT education in the United States. For the most part, I can't speak to other parts of the country, but trauma-informed care is definitely a hot topic in occupational therapy.
Awesome. Mm-hmm. Well, then good. Trauma-informed care, very, very great, very important. And as professionals, like getting that trauma-informed care, sometimes understanding the way that trauma works, not only in... like when someone's experienced a trauma, this is kind of how they will be as people. But in a more nuanced perspective of like, when it comes to sexual trauma, what does that mean when talking about sex with people? Not even like doing any type of body work or working around a sexual issue, mm-hmm. but just the way that can be. And so there's a couple books that are really, really good that I think the listeners might really appreciate.
Tell us. Oh, yes.
Maybe you've heard a couple of these before. One of them is called The Body Keeps the Score.
I've heard that one.
Yeah, by Bessel van der Kolk. Really fantastic. Bessel van der Kolk, one of my favorite things is throughout history, van der Kolk started writing earlier on in psychology, talking about embodiment and trauma in one way, and now has kind of like expanded and shifted in certain ways to understand the way that the body can ingrain and memorize traumas, and then the way that that affects how people view things as safe things or not safe things.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And then there's a another one that's kind of similar called, I could read my writing. No, I can't. I put it over here. It's okay. Stacey Haynes is so in the therapy world, when we talk about sex therapy, Stacey Haynes has a really, really good book called Healing Sex.
Okay.
Which...
A mind-body approach to healing sexual trauma.
Yeah, you know this book?
I just looked it up.
Oh, great.
Adding it to my list.
Yes, mind-body approach, because quite frankly, the clinicians, the talk therapy, the psychologists, they deal with a lot of the mind part.
Mm-hmm.
And you all have a wonderful opportunity to deal with the body part
mm-hmm.
in ways that most talk therapists don't get to deal with, right? Talk therapists can talk about what does your body mean to you? Why is this an important thing? But they don't get to actually help someone move their body in many ways. Because that is, against the ethics there. But you all get to talk to people and then touch people and help people do things.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah. And so the healing sex, that's a really good one, as well as The Body Remembers. That was the one that I couldn't
read. Remembers.
The Body Remembers by Rothschild. That's more of a like a psychophysiology approach.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, the subtitle is The Psychophysiology of Trauma and Trauma Treatment.
Okay. I'm adding all of these to my list.
Oh, good. And maybe I know that OTs are super busy and like very rarely have time to sit down and like read entire books on this.
Yeah, we're
so
nerdy though.
Yeah, I personally love audiobooks because I have a quite long commute. So that's where I get all of my information is pop it out on the drive, podcasts and audiobooks.
Oh, nice. Well, I wonder if these are audiobooks. I don't actually know the answer to that.
I'm going to keep talking. I'm going to look that up.
And then... one of the last ones that I have here that you all actually might know, because you all talk about a lot, sex and disabilities, right, when it comes to OT?
Yeah.
Which I think it has interesting philosophical implications, but M-A-T, and then E with an apostrophe over it. When the body says no, and this is a really interesting discussion. The subtitle is Exploring the Stress Disease Connection.
Oh,
and this is largely a talk about like sex and disability and the way that bodies are, that sexuality is affected by like the state of our bodies, and specifically the way that that interacts with disease and change and to some extent the healthcare field.
Mm-hmm.
And so that might be a really good source for people to look at, especially if they're in the sex and disability world. In the field of sexuality, that's right, our broad umbrella, we have tons of like subcategories to study. And one of them that we talk about is sex and disabilities.
Okay.
Now that's the language that a lot of sexuality professionals will use. And then of course, in the sex and disabilities, there's a whole bunch of other sub discussions that go on. Mm-hmm. And so, do you all know, Robin Wilson Beatty or Bethany Stevens? They are really important. I don't know about, I mean, yes, I mean, everyone's important, right? but they do really important work around sex and disabilities. Bethany Stevens is a disability consultant, and the way that politics and pleasure kind of work around sex and disabilities. Uh-huh. And then Robin Wilson Beatty, I actually love her Twitter. I think her Twitter handle is @sexabled. Yeah. I'm pretty sure, yeah. And she is also like an educator and activist, does a really good job of bringing into the folds the understanding. She was actually, Robin was a speaker at ASECT this past year and did a really good job of bringing up the concept of interconnectedness, right? And how we are all kind of interconnected in different ways that impact the way that we interact with each other. Mm-hmm. And so listeners can follow them on social media. They're really, really good about bringing up conversations and like really important points and things that with sex and disabilities is oftentimes not considered or under considered.
Right? I can confirm that The Body Keeps Score has an audio version. And Healing Sex has audio version. It doesn't look like The Body Remembers.
When the Body Says No also has an audiobook version of it as well.
Oh, wow.
Remembers is the only one that maybe doesn't.
Yeah.
Oh, that is quite all right. But also awesome because now there's so many great audiobooks. When I was young, I mean, this is my oldness kicking in. When I was young, these books on tape.
Pretty sure I'm very much older than you, but go on.
I don't know. The books on tape. Watch it. They were, you know, you get them at the library, and then you have to watch it, like listen to them, and like, you know.
Yeah,
and your Walkman, and and then you have like 30 tapes that you had to listen to.
So what I'm saying is, shout out to all the way that we can now access audiobooks. That's really great.
Like,
and
information, and it's accessible.
Cool.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
All right, more ways to be comfortable talking about sex with
clients. More ways, right. So actually, one of the last book reference I will give relates again to the first one of like working through your own stuff. Sometimes as clinicians, there's a clever book called The Wounded Healer. And that's a nice book and people can read it. But the book that I'm thinking of referencing is called Sexual Healing Journey by Wendy Maltz, Maltz. She is a sex therapist who does a lot of good work around trauma. And what that book does is that as clinicians, as human service professions, as practitioners, sometimes we've experienced traumatic sexual events, and that's going to impact the way that we talk about it with others and the way that we will hear others. Mm-hmm. Sometimes we need to kind of work through our own stuff in order to be the best sexuality professional for someone else. Mm-hmm. And that book does a really good job of helping one understand what trauma can look like in a broad sense and how to work through it in different ways. And Wendy gives a really good discussion of it can look like trauma, sexual trauma can express in these ways. It can look like these things and all of that's totally normal. And with each of these kind of embodiments of trauma, this is how you can kind of work through those things. And so if a practitioner or a counselor is not sure how to go about addressing that, and like, you know, of course, talking in therapy is a really, really good option. Mm-hmm. I teach a lot of, counseling professionals when it comes to mental health counseling. In OT, so in mental health counseling, it's almost like an expected imperative that you have a counselor yourself, because you're going to be hearing a lot of things that are uncomfortable and you can get vicarious trauma from. Interesting. Yeah. In OT, do they have a similar message or not?
No.
So I don't know the field of OT too well, but that might sound like a place that we can destigmatize going to therapy mm-hmm. also, because going to therapy is really important. And you all, as people who work with other people's bodies, and in certain places in the sexuality world, we call that body workers. Mm-hmm. Is that a term that you all like might use or not use to talk about?
I don't think I've ever heard that term.
Mainly because within the field of OT, it's not necessarily just working on the physical body. There is a mental health component mm-hmm. in it too. So it's a very holistic practice. So I think that's why we probably really hear that term so much.
In the world of sexuality, there's people who are allowed to touch bodies and people who are not.
Interesting.
Like a massage therapist, body worker. They work with bodies. As a sexuality educator, a sexuality therapist, you're not allowed to touch people's bodies. That's usually an ethical issue with licensure or certification in different ways. And so you all have licenses that allow you to touch other people.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Is the point of that. And so working as, lost my train of thought again. Oh, well, body working, super important. And knowing about, you know, your own stuff and what that can.
We're talking about too, because you were talking about kind of having your own mental health professional to work through.
Oh, yeah.
That is. Because I do think, you know, a lot of times when we talk about empathy and the importance of empathy in our work, mm-hmm. we talk a lot about still maintaining that boundary.
Uh-huh.
Really difficult, and actually that's probably a really good recommendation to help maintain that boundary, is having your own counselor, your own
and I can say too, yeah. from the people that I know a lot of OT practitioners that do have their own counselors and people that they see, but I don't think it's explicitly stated. I think there's a lot of stress, and sometimes that comes into some of the places that we work,
and it's an emotionally draining job, yeah. and that ties into then a
yeah.
separate podcast probably with burnout issues and occupational therapy and mm-hmm. combat burnout, because we are in such intimate situations with people, not just physically like that body worker idea. We're, you know, say we're in the bathroom with them, we're doing that physical aspect, but then we're also hearing all of these things that may not even be related to the, say, stroke they just had. It could be their daughter's going through a divorce and mm-hmm. cancer,
and especially
a lot to take on.
If you're working with someone long term, you become almost like this, like, extension of their family. Mm-hmm. Like, you know everything right. about them, that, you know, like, you'll or you know, you have to deal with sometimes a client may die, and then having mm-hmm. to deal with how do we then process that I've been part of this person's life for so long, and mm-hmm. now
we're often the only ones. I mean, I used to kind of a joke where I used to work, they'd always be like, how do you know all these things about, like, how do you know these intimate details? And I'm like, well, I'm an OT, like, it's my job.
I know them. That's how that works. So it sounds like there's a lot of emotional labor and emotional dumping that might happen on OTs, right? Yeah. And so it's really good. Yeah.
Which is why we have to be trained in mental health and have that mental health background, because we have that intimate relationship yeah. with clients.
Right. Oh my gosh. So having a therapist of one's own is really important to talk about these things with.
Great advice. Like,
yeah.
So that is something, and especially, like, we were relating this, I remember now where we were going, we were relating this to sexual trauma, and if an occupational therapist has experienced sexual trauma, you know, I might feel uncomfortable working with other people if I had experienced sexual trauma and don't know how to talk about it. Mm-hmm. And so on the one hand, like, there's always the refer out that we talk about in mental health, right? Refer to someone who can help this person better. But I also know that sometimes that's not an option.
Yeah.
Especially in many rural places. Mm-hmm. Right? You're the only OT for, I don't know, 100 miles. And so referring out might not be an option, but having a therapist that you go to kind of like, I don't know, I heard this really messed up thing about my one client's like daughter's divorce, and like that had me a little messed up. I'd like to like unload about.
So I have a question.
Yeah.
Advice to a practitioner, you know, you talk about kind of knowing your own shit, owning your own shit. What if your own shit is you don't think people should have sex outside marriage? You don't, you think homosexuality is a sin? How do you then, because to me, you need to find a way to leave that at the door, but that's again easier said than done as someone that doesn't have those.
Right. Yeah, definitely. And that I've heard you use the words cultural competence before.
Yeah.
And this is a sub conversation under cultural competence or cultural literacy, right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And so how do we manage our values along with things that maybe are contrary to our values? And that's one of my favorite areas of working with healthcare professionals. And there's a book by Pamela Hayes called Looking Into the Clinician's Mirrors. I said that was the last book I would reference, and I lied. Okay. So this one. Yeah,
it's my fault. Blame me.
And Looking Into the Clinician's Mirror is a really good, I believe the subtitle or maybe the chapter I'm thinking of is Cultural Self-Assessment.
Okay.
It might be like the first chapter or something, and I use that chapter a lot. The whole book is great and like dated in different ways, but the cultural self-assessment can get one to say like, okay, when I say I'm bringing stuff to the door, because some people who might feel those things about, you know, homosexuality or maybe different types of sex, I have interacted with so many people around so many different topics. I, for example, have talked to some women who say, you know, other women who say that they enjoy anal sex are just lying. They're just trying to get men's attention.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've heard that.
And, you know, and for someone who maybe anal penetration has been tried and it was uncomfortable, that makes sense that they might feel that, mm-hmm. Right? Yeah. But it's also really important to understand that there are different experiences.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And so Hayes's chapter on this cultural self-assessment.
So I found the book, for the record. The title of the book is Addressing Cultural Complexities in Practice. A framework for clinicians and counselors.
Yeah.
And then the chapter, good. Yeah, the chapter is looking into the clinicians.
Oh, thank you. Good, yeah. good. Yep. again, with this information. Oh, we're so blessed. Looking into the clinician's mirror, this chapter does a really good job of walking people through understanding like, okay, what is it that I bring? And how do you leave it at the door when that's easier said than done?
Yeah.
And the answer is exposure and practice.
Okay.
Exposure and practice. And so this is why when ASECT certified.
With a willingness.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, so definitely.
That starts with the owning your shit part.
Yes. There's a willingness to own it and then a willingness to practice.
Yeah. Yeah.
This is very true. And that's tough when I just had a friend who was talking with their supervisor, a psychologist, talking about working with polyamorous families.
Mm-hmm.
Do you talk about polyamorous
families? We have a few things kind of lined up in the future.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. So for listeners, polyamory is kind of one of these alternatives to monogamy. A monogamous relationship is one partner. Polyamory, poly many, amory, love. So having many loves. So having more than one partner in a deep and intimate way.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Cliff Notes version. And so
I love that definition. I think you did that beautifully.
And I think more common than people realize.
Yeah, that's so. This psychologist was talking with her supervisor about working with poly families or polyamorous families. And her supervisor says, well, I think any clinician should be able to work with poly families because they're just trained and that's it. And the fact of the matter is that that's not the case.
Yeah.
Because many psychologists would come to it and say, no, you need one partner, and sex with someone else outside of that is cheating.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm going to help you rein in what's the word for slutty, but the like scientific word?
You can use slutty.
Your promiscuous behavior.
Scientific term for slutty?
That's what the psychologist would say, right? And so we can't assume that all clinicians, what's that?
The term's only used for women generally.
Right. This is very true. Right. And that's a different conversation. You have whore and then you have man whore. Like, wait a minute. What about, which I saw these really interesting shirts that, well, were like raising awareness about this interesting, then they had male engineer on them. So that people would be like, now I'm checking my biases, right?
Yeah. So promiscuous.
Promiscuous, right. So, at which, yes, which of course there's a lot of issues with that term too. That's a different discussion. But this, this psychologist was like, no, actually there are very specific problems with polyfamilies or issues that polyfamilies might encounter that regular clinicians who haven't been trained in that would not be able to handle. And so when it comes to checking your own stuff and then keeping it at the door, is recognizing, okay, what is it that I'm going to encounter?
Mm-hmm.
And so with ASEC certification, for example, one of the things is that they help people expose themselves to these things so that it's not a surprise when they encounter it.
Mm-hmm.
And so if someone maybe has an issue with the concept of two men having a similar sexual interaction or a same-sex interaction, they need to first understand, like, well, yes, men do have sex with other men,
mm-hmm.
and then encounter that in different ways. Talking to, you know, gay men about their experience, like seeking out that information in different capacities to raise one's comfort level and awareness, understanding one's biases about why they have this hang up. Do I have this hang up because of my religious affiliation, my religious belief? Do I have this hang up because of something I experienced in my life? You know, because there, we talk about big T trauma and little T trauma,
mm-hmm.
right? And like cat calls, for example, for a lot of women or female presenting people walking down the street, getting cat called, not big T trauma usually, but they build up and then it becomes a frustrating experience. That happens a lot.
Yeah.
And so are there maybe little T traumas that have happened with a person that makes them, makes letting go of that concept or keeping it at the door, so to speak, more difficult for them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Right? And so doing a lot of that work and exposure and practice, seeing, understanding more, and then practicing, hey, you know, can you assume the role of this person? I want to practice hearing this and practice like addressing it and like watching my face.
Mm-hmm.
That's one of the things we talk a lot about in the health sciences is, hey, so you're going to hear some things. You're going to need to check your face sometimes.
Yeah. All those nonverbals and body language things that you might not realize you're doing.
Right. Or one of my favorites for people who are like, oh, we're like so open, is they hear a thing, their eyes get really wide and they're like, mm-hmm, okay, I'm ready. Right. And they like grip up and they're like, we could talk about this. I'm totally open. And then the person's like,
maybe not.
Way more uncomfortable.
I have no problem with anything you just said.
Boys get high, they start talking fast.
Yep. Yeah. And that is, I mean, yes, that's a normal reaction that people who are not that skilled in hearing things might experience. And but so
your point of that, like, repetition, like, this is my takeaway right now. First, mm-hmm. own your shit, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep. Mm-hmm.
Second,
yep.
Educate yourself.
Yep.
And then practice it and keep over and over. The practice and repetition, practice and repetition, you get better. It's super simplified.
Right.
Yeah, that was really, really good. And it's so true. Educate yourself on the trauma, educate yourself on the language, educate yourself. Actually, one of the things I had listed here was listen to the lives of people's experience. Mm-hmm. And their experience of seeking out medical help or healthcare, because one of the curriculum that I had written with a colleague of mine, Stephanie Shando, she's a palliative care social worker. Mm-hmm. And so she helps people with issues. She helps people generally with end of life care. And she specifically looks at the intersection of end of life and sexuality. Mm-hmm. And so we wrote a curriculum on healthcare professionals interacting with alternative sexual behaviors. So people who might do things like kink or BDSM, mm-hmm. they might, you know, come into the doctors with maybe bruises on them or different types of things that a doctor might be very concerned about, right? And in the medical, in the sex and medicine literature, we see that doctors and healthcare professionals are very minimally prepared to talk about sex.
Sure, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And clients or patients will expect their healthcare professional to bring it up.
Yes, yes.
And so we have this huge gap mm-hmm. where there's, hey, I'm waiting for my client to bring it up. The patient's like, I'm waiting for my, you know, professional who knows all the things to bring it up. Mm-hmm. And then no one does. Oh, okay, I guess it's not that important. I just won't talk about it.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, yeah.
And so listening to those people's experience of like, hey, I actually don't know. I hear a lot of it about doctors and going to doctor's visits. I haven't heard too much about people going to occupational therapists and their experience of if their therapist has brought up sex or not. And I'm guessing there's studies on it, but I don't know.
I don't know if we've, I've been trying to research kind of like where, you know, how many practitioners are really addressing this in practice. We're getting a lot, I'm finding a lot on, you know, how much is there an education where they're addressing it. But in practice, and it kind of, you know, or really, I guess they're taking it from the perspective of when students are in field work, how much exposure are they getting to it in field work? So that's kind of the way, well, when you're in the field, you've learned about it, is it happening? And we're kind of getting some anecdotal evidence too from some people that we've been talking about their experiences. Like, so we had an episode with Andrew uh-huh. Gerka, and he talked about, well, what was his first experience with an OT and bringing up uh-huh.
And oh, wonderful.
And it did not go so well.
Oh, that's such a bummer. Oh, no.
So that's what I'm
And so for OT is part of that educating yourself, like getting those experiences and like following people on Twitter that you don't normally follow and like, you
listen to OT After Dark.
Woohoo!
Listen to OT After Dark, right? A really great way of learning. Yep. And I did have one more thing. I'm sorry, I almost missed. Is make a connection with sex therapists around your area, because sometimes there are going to be things that you're like, hey, I can't deal with this, but it's, what's going to be really good is you going to a sex therapist.
Yeah, yeah.
While we work together. And sex therapists would love that. They would love having another clinician in a relationship with a client.
That can do the hands-on.
Yes, that are like, hey, like, have you tried this? Have you thought of this? And the clinician can be like, or the therapist can be like, oh, I didn't, you know what, this is a really good, I'm glad that we're having this conversation. Anyways, it would be great. You can find those in many different ways, but also depending on your state, anyone can call themselves a sex therapist.
Mm-hmm.
So watch out for that. One way of being at least a little more sure is to go to the ASECT website, asect.org, and you can search for certified sex therapists in your area.
And do you happen to know, because we have some international listeners too, how uh-huh. those outside of the United States can find sex therapists?
So there's a couple different organizations. There's there's a research one called IASR, or the International Association of Sex Research. There's going to be people connected to that. There's many a group in the United States that has some international people is called STAR, S-S-T-A-R, Society for the Scientific Study, Society for Sexuality, Research and Therapy.
Okay.
That doesn't spell STAR, but the point is it's something. I did not major in spelling. But they're really good. IASR, there's another one, World Association of Sexual Health, or WAS, W-A-S. It was World Association of Sexology. They changed it to sexual health, but then they were like, we don't want to be an organization called WASH, because who wants to be part of a sex health organization that says WASH? Like, we're not about that. So they still call it WAS, W-A-S. They have professionals all over the world, specifically around sexual health. And so there are definitely clinicians associated with those places. But when it comes to a repository of like, hey, can I Google someone who's a sex therapist around me? I think that varies greatly by country and the way that certification works there. So,
okay.
Yeah. And WAS would actually probably be a really great place to go to be like, hey, I'm in this country. What options do I have?
Excellent. Great. Yeah. Great.
I think this has been amazing.
Yes, Mark, thank you so much for being on OT After Dark. This has been a wonderful conversation. I feel like I've gained so much from this.
I feel like you're going to have to be a future guest.
Well, thanks. Yeah, happy. Thanks so much for having me. This was great.
Excellent.
Yep.
I hope everyone enjoyed that conversation with Mark, Dr. Mark.
I had
he
a blast.
He deserves the Dr. Mark credit there.
He worked hard for that, Dr. Mark.
I think that was fantastic. So let's go to I kind of brought this up when we were talking to you. My takeaways, what we really need to remember. Number one, own your own shit.
Number two, educate yourself.
Number three, take that education and put it into practice.
And number four, repeat.
All right. Don't forget, sex is an ADL.
Cheers!